Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. The Justice Department has blown through a deadline set by House Democrats to hand over the unredacted Mueller report. Now, the House Judiciary Committee will consider holding Attorney General William Barr in contempt of Congress. Let's start there with NPR national political correspondent Mara Liasson, who joins us now. Hi, Mara.
Hi, Jeremy.
So the deadline passed this morning at 9 a.m. Eastern Time. What happens now?
Well, the House Judiciary Committee Chairman Gerald Nadler says that the committee is going to vote on contempt, a contempt citation for not complying with their subpoena for the Mueller report. And that could mean that Attorney General Barr will be held in contempt.
And what does that mean if he's held in contempt by Congress?
Well, that is the big question, because Congress doesn't have a kind of enforcement arm of its own, doesn't have a police department, but it means probably that this goes to court. And this kind of thing has happened in the past. Eric Holder, who was President Obama's attorney general, was held in contempt. He didn't want to cooperate on a certain investigation called Fast and Furious. But these things go to court, and most legal experts will say that Congress has the stronger legal stand here because they have a constitutional requirement or responsibility to do oversight of the executive branch. But what Donald Trump has decided to do is really spark a kind of constitutional crisis or separation of powers confrontation, where he is saying that we will fight all the subpoenas, not just the Mueller report, his tax returns, other requests from Congress for oversight. He's going to fight all of them. It's a kind of blanket policy. And that is a real, in the stress test on democratic institutions that Trump continues to provide, this one is a big one, because respecting a co-equal branch of government is how our system works. And Trump is pretty much saying that he doesn't think that a Democratic Congress should be able to do oversight on the executive branch.
Well, and that brings us to another thing that the president has just said, which is that he now doesn't want Robert Mueller, the special counsel, to testify on Capitol Hill. He had previously said he wouldn't prevent Mueller from testifying and called it William Barr's decision. Barr has said he had no objection. Why is Trump now reversing positions if, as he has said, Mara, that the Mueller report is a total exoneration of him? Why wouldn't he want to hear from Mueller?
Well, that's a really good question. We have to assume that he thinks that Mueller would say things that would be that would undermine him, that would be damaging to him. There's no other reason for him to say that Mueller shouldn't testify. Now, the question is, what power does he have to prevent Mueller from testifying? Right now, Mueller is an employee of the Justice Department, and presumably Bill Barr could stop him from testifying, although Barr has said it's fine with him. Very soon, Mueller will become a private citizen, and then I don't know who could stop him from testifying. I think there's no legal power that the president would have to stop him. Now, maybe the president's personal wishes have some kind of hold some kind of weight with Bob Mueller. I don't know.
We are going to have to see what happens with that. And by the way, the testimony could come as soon as next week.
Yes, that's
the day
that Congress has asked for. Right.
Michael Cohen is now an inmate. The former personal attorney for the president checked into prison today. Spoke with reporters first, though. Here he is.
I hope that when I rejoin my family and friends, that the country will be in a place without xenophobia, injustice, and lies at the helm of our country. There still remains much to be told, and I look forward to the day that I can share the truth.
Mara, what's the significance of what's happening now? Cohen going to prison finally.
He's going to prison. That isn't going to stop him from cooperating with prosecutors. Presumably, he's given them everything he knows already. But it's unclear if he is just angling for a field trip from the Club Fed in Otisville, New York, where he's checking into today, or if he has some new piece of information that he could give to investigators or the Southern District of New York. That's unclear. But Michael Cohen is going to jail. He was the president's lawyer and fixer. Paul Manafort, the former campaign chairman for the Trump campaign, is in jail. And, you know, if I don't think we'll hear from them again unless they have something big and new that we don't know about.
One more thing, Mara, we got to talk about the 2020 race, because I thought we had all the candidates already, but it sounds like there are more coming on the Democratic side. New York Mayor Bill de Blasio is expected to announce he's going to get into it. He'd be the 22nd confirmed Democratic candidate, with others still considering a run. Why are all these people getting into this race right now? What do they think they're going to bring to the table?
Well, each one of them thinks they're going to bring something else to the table. But what's interesting, people run for president for many different reasons. Some of them think they have a clear path and a way to win. Some of them want to raise their name recognition in preparation for another race for governor or senator. Sometimes on the Republican side, we see people who seem to be angling for a Fox News contract or a book contract. It's unclear what de Blasio hopes to accomplish here. I haven't seen any big chorus of New Yorkers saying, run, Bill, run. As a matter of fact, it's been quite the opposite.
Right.
So I'm not sure. But look, I think that this Democratic field is going to sort itself out pretty soon into top-tier serious candidates and candidates that can't break 1%. You know, there will be debates where you have to have a certain standing in the polls and a certain number of contributions from a certain number of people in order to be on the debate stage. That'll be one winnowing factor. But I think pretty soon we're going to be only talking about the 5, 6, 7 candidates that really have a chance.
But just briefly, it must be very difficult for them to raise money in such a crowded field.
Well, there's a lot of money out there. What was really interesting to me was how easy it was for many candidates, including minor ones. I think John Hickenlooper raised $1 million on his first day in the race. So the low-hanging fruit, the low-hanging money is easy to get, but it's hard to get the really big money over time.
NPR national political correspondent Mara Liasson, thank you.
Thank you.
And a pivot here to a problem close to home. The National Council on Problem Gambling is reporting that up to 8 million Americans struggle with a gambling habit. And experts say that Asian Americans may have a heightened risk for problem gambling. Fortune and luck are important in some Asian cultures. The tradition of playing cards and throwing dice at family gatherings and holidays goes back generations. And now, Southeast Asian refugees who came to the U.S. after the Vietnam War are especially at risk. Connecticut Public Radio's Vanessa De La Torre reports.
Quinn Truong still gets a cozy feeling when she sees a deck of cards. Truong came to the U.S. as a kid, a refugee from Vietnam. Her extended family resettled in Connecticut, and when they get together on the weekends, gambling was a way they bonded.
Everybody has a roll of quarters and nickels and dimes and pennies that they use, and they bet against each other. And so all the kids are rooting for their parents, and then, you know, we kind of check in on them every once in a while.
Truong's now a healthcare advocate in Hartford who specializes in gambling addiction. Connecticut has two of the biggest casinos in the U.S., casinos that cater to Asians with cultural entertainment and translated signs that feel welcoming, Truong says. For some Southeast Asian refugees still dealing with trauma from the war, she says the gambling scene can be an escape.
You get involved in this activity that is fun, and every once in a while you make it big and you get a couple $100 and you feel like the king of the world. Of course you're going to go for that, right? If you lose, though, you lose big.
Dr. Timothy Fong is professor of addiction psychiatry at UCLA's Gambling Studies program. Fong says Southeast Asian refugees are at risk of falling into problem gambling, partly because of their trauma history. The high of gambling is a way of seeking comfort, Fong says. Some refugees also think they can make fast money.
Gambling is seen as an opportunity out of poverty. And when you have tremendous amounts of poverty, particularly in the Southeast Asian refugee population, that tends to be a very tempting idea.
The numbers back that up. Experts point to a 2003 survey led by UConn Health Center. Researchers focused on almost 100 refugees from Vietnam, Cambodia, and Laos who were living in Connecticut. They found almost 60% of them were addicted to gambling,
which is almost 30 times the national average for gambling addiction.
Making matters more complicated, Asians are least likely among ethnic groups in the U.S. to use mental health services. I met Howard Pengsapong at a Connecticut conference on problem gambling. He's 71 and says he comes from a generation of refugees that carries a lot of stress. But Pengsapong says it's hard in this culture to talk about mental health.
The mental health is, we don't even have the word exist in our Laotian language. If we translate word by word, it's like a crazy.
Advocates say not wanting to be labeled as crazy or bring shame to one's family is why problem gambling cases tend to stay hidden until there's a crisis. And when gambling spirals out of control, It can lead to suicidal thoughts, bankruptcy, broken families, says Peng Sipong.
That's why we try to give a message to our community members just to be mindful of the consequences of this gambling.
To give that message, the state of Connecticut has turned to Asian ambassadors, immigrants like Peng Sipong and Truong, who hold sessions in their communities on the warning signs of problem gambling. Some experts think it could serve as a national model on how to reach minorities on a topic that's considered taboo. It's so sensitive that even the term problem gambling is a problem, says Truong and her Laotian colleague Sue Tamavong. She's also an ambassador.
You can't say problem gambling because you say problem gambling, people are going to be like, nope, not a problem, I'm out. Or if you say, I think one we did was financial literacy.
Financial literacy.
Good. And it was so good. And there was one little section about gambling, and then all of a sudden, all these questions came out.
The Asian ambassadors say they're not trying to discourage gambling. The important thing is self-awareness, they say. And if gambling gets to be a problem, being able to talk about it. For Here and Now, I'm Vanessa De La Torre in Hartford.
For decades, Glenda Jackson has dazzled, winning two Oscars, Women in Love and A Touch of Class, as well as two Emmys for her Queen and the BBC's Elizabeth R. Then she became a member of Parliament, she said, to take on Conservative Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher.
We were told that everything I had been taught to regard as a vice, and I still regard them as vices, under Thatcherism was in fact a virtue. Greed, selfishness, no care for the weaker, sharp elbows, sharp knees.
When I first was elected, somebody said to me, how are you going to manage working in this all-male club? And I said, well, that's been my experience all my life, and that was true.
Now at 82, Glenda Jackson is playing a man, King Lear, in the new gender-bending Broadway production.
Now we have divided in three our kingdom, and 'tis our first intent to shake all cares and busyness from our age, conferring them on younger strengths.
Lear's decision there to divide his land among his daughters will be one he will regret. Two of them turn on him, the third, Cordelia, his favorite, he banishes. Ruth Wilson plays Cordelia and Lear's fool, the young man, as we hear in the scene, who tells him things others dare not.
Oh, if only I had two coxcombs and two daughters.
Why, my boy?
Well, if I gave them all my living, I'd keep my coxcombs myself. There's mine. Beg another of thy daughters.
Take heed, sirrah, the
whip. Oh, yes, truth's a dog.
Lovely to meet you. Hello, big fan.
We sat down with both Glenda Jackson and Ruth Wilson in Glenda's tiny backstage dressing room, where I admitted I was scared to death of this outspoken icon. I want to read you back, Glenda Jackson, some of the descriptions of you.
Oh, please.
Wonderful. You entered an interview like a blade flung by a circus thrower seeking its target. You were described as like a gleaming scythe slashing an overgrown field.
Me?
Gleaming scythe.
Me?
A blade.
Oh, my God. There are two things that have been said about me that I never understand. One is that I'm frightening. I find that impossible to believe. And the other is that I speak in complete sentences. Well, don't we all speak in complete sentences? I mean, what does that mean?
After leaving Parliament, Glenda Jackson went to see a friend, a woman, playing Lear in Spain. At the same time, Glenda began getting offers for work.
Well, I was very surprised that I was invited back, actually. And she said, why don't you do it? And I said, don't be ridiculous. They'd never let me do Lear in England. Then the suggestion of King Lear came up again, and that's how it happened.
Well, you know, that's funny because I was, of course, wanted to know, had you always thought, well, I could do that. Why couldn't a woman do that? But no, you actually didn't think that.
Absolutely not, no. It is a privilege to be in this play.
Well, and Ruth Wilson, here you are in this play. Mm-hmm. Your character, the fool especially, in the scene on the heath, curled sometimes, you know, like a cat around the Lear that as Cordelia you can't touch, mm-hmm. but as the fool you can. Mm-hmm. You walk on, you make entrances together. It's almost like a Charlie Chaplin, you know, variety act. You're like plastered right behind her, your arms and your legs in sync.
She occasionally gets a thud for doing that.
Yeah, too close?
Yes.
But I was wondering, and I know she's sitting right here, mm-hmm. but what's it like to inhale Glenda Jackson?
Wow. It's amazing. No, Glenda's been amazing to work with.
Glenda's very tactile with the Fool and loving towards the Fool, whereas Cordelia is the kind of, there's a conflict.
Well, yes, and also, of course, Lear says, where's my Fool? And everybody says virtually, well, ever since Cordelia's gone, he's blown it. So there is that link between the two characters as well.
Well, they're the truth tellers.
Absolutely.
Yeah. You've said going out on stage is always like being on a high diving board and not knowing if there's water in the pool.
Absolutely. I pray.
Yeah, it's frightening. And I find it with this play, it's kind of mad because, I mean, the whole show is like a nightmare. And it's so extreme and I'm just like, ugh, I think every time before I go on, it's like
dull ache of like fear.
But because every performance is the first one. I mean, you've not played to that audience before. And I've decided we're all sadomasochists, actually, who enter this profession. But for me, if I don't really feel afraid, I'm really, really very worried. You know, where are you? Where's your head? Come on. It's.
I think we all find God the moment before we go on.
It's I like certainly a sign thank of a cross.
Yeah. And Lear seems to find him over the course of the play.
He realises his lapse is... I mean, certainly that speech where he talks about poor naked wretches, that is a revelatory moment for that man.
Poor naked wretches, wheresoever you are, that by the pelting of this pitiless storm, and with your houseless heads, your unfed sides, your looped and windowed raggedness, defend thee from seasons such as this. I have taken too little care of this.
I was thinking last night watching you that you get the one line on Lear, demented, falling into dementia. And to me, he was falling into knowledge and sanity.
Absolutely. Absolutely he does. Self-awareness. And yes, I mean, on one level, of course, he's way, way off in some other world. But the realities of life for other people is something that is suddenly, he gets punched in the nose. Because, you know, his whole life, no one's ever said no to him. And he realises, A, he's been cheated by those people. And there is this sense of awareness within him, which is amazing.
Talk about the physicality for you. I didn't care about gender at all within seconds.
No one has ever mentioned it to me.
But I'm wondering if for you, in crafting the character, was there a gesture that you brought to it? You
know? No, what I brought to it was when I was an MP, I had to visit old people's homes, day centres, things of that nature. And one of the very interesting things that I saw over the years, that as we, as individuals, grow older, those absolute barriers which define our gender begin to crack. They begin to fray. They get a bit smoky. And if you think about it, you know, babies are born and then we teach them what their gender is. But as we get older, those areas begin to fray. And I find that quite useful. And somebody said to me the other night, quite amazingly, she said, I've seen this play many times. She said, it's the first time I've seen that maternal side of Lear. And I thought that was very interesting.
At a certain point during the play, I got very emotional because I was like, what am I seeing? I recognize this. And it was my mother.
There you go.
When she had the night terrors.
Yeah.
You're nodding.
Well, because other people have said similar things to me about their parents. And I understand that.
And then in the morning, her face pulled right up and let's go to IHOP and get a pancake.
That's one of the amazing things about getting old. I mean, the inside me, I think I'm about 15. But unfortunately, the envelope that carries me along refuses to do what I tell it to do. I mean, it has its own ideas about picking things up and walking and all that. It's very, very disobedient. And the other amazing thing about getting older is you realise how much you don't know. It's just staggering.
Ruth Wilson, there's so much that's so universal when families fight. You've had a project that many of us have been glued to the television here in the States watching Mrs. Wilson, which is your telling, you play the role of your grandmother, who discovered after her husband died of a heart attack that he, in fact, was a serial bigamist spy.
Yeah, an incredible story. And we only found it all out in the last 10 years. I mean, it was quite spiritual, really. I don't think I've really processed it properly. Every day, getting inside my grandmother's skin, which is profound. You know, when you're a kid, you put adults on a pedestal and you see them in a certain way. And certainly to get under my grandmother at the age of 19
and to tell her story and then tell my dad's story at the age of 18. That's been really amazing for me.
Glenda, you've been nodding while she's been talking, and I'm thinking of how you've said that you've worked with men most of your life because the theater doesn't have as many roles for women. I'm wondering if you are looking over at Ruth and thinking, it's changed a bit.
It hasn't changed at all. I mean, it's really scandalous, I find, that contemporary dramatists don't find women interesting. We are rarely, if ever, the central dramatic engine where there is some kind of adjunct. There have been major changes, and still, that has not crept into the modern dramatist's view of the world, and I find that quite bemusing, actually.
And even if they're the lead, they're often still the victims. I mean, I've been frustrated myself, and that is a way of why I've been making my own work. We're all conditioned by the patriarchy. So even women are writing stories which still have women at the centre who are victims.
Linda's head is about to explode.
Well, no, I mean, what I wanted to add, there is still the prevailing underbelly that if a woman is successful, she's the exception that proves the rule. If a woman is a failure, they're all failures. And that has not shifted. And even though we have made strides and will hopefully continue to make them, it's very hard.
Just one last question, Ruth Wilson. So what is it like to be, like, right next to Glenda Jackson, like, curled up next? Is there, like, a spark?
She treats me with overwhelming contempt.
I was just thinking maybe a special electrical field or some, like...
Yeah, I get an electric shock every time I get close. Oh, yeah. No. Honestly, Glenda, it's amazing being with you because I don't know what she's drinking. She's on some sort of energy juice that I need to have. No, she's amazing.
Good God, your energy levels are marvellous. What about you dancing on that table? It's amazing.
No,
there's so much energy in the play. If we touch into that, it just drives us forward, doesn't it?
When you're interacting and firing with each other, that's absolutely. That's why you do the job.
Of course it is.
Glenda, Ruth, thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
King Lear stars Ruth Wilson and Glenda Jackson. And a crime has been committed. Glenda Jackson was not nominated for a Tony for her Lear, maybe because she won last year for Edward Albee's Three Tall Women. But Ruth Wilson was nominated for Feature Actress. They are both extraordinary.
This message comes from Here and Now's sponsor, Ember Wave. Ember Wave, the revolutionary new personal thermostat that is designed to help you find thermal wellness in any situation. Ember Wave can put you in control of your comfort in places like your freezing office, uncomfortable airplanes, cold restaurants, after a workout, at home, and more. Named one of Time Magazine's best inventions of 2018. Learn more at emberwave.com. Ember Wave, balance through temperature.
Stocks fell this morning after President Trump threatened over the weekend to raise tariffs on some Chinese goods from 10% to 25% starting on Friday. The U.S. and China were thought to be nearing a trade deal this week. Let's bring in Jill Schlesinger, business analyst at CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Hi, Jill.
Hello.
So what do you make of this? Why is the president threatening to increase tariffs at a time when both sides have been working to roll them back?
First of all, I think you might be forgiven if you kind of lost track of where we stand with the trade conflict with China. So right now, U.S. has imposed tariffs of 25% on $50 billion worth of Chinese goods. And then there was another round, 10% on $200 billion worth of Chinese exports to the U.S. Then in December, the two sides kind of took a timeout. They said, let's negotiate, which actually has been pretty good. We'd heard that they were making some progress. But it does appear that President Trump is trying to amp up the pressure on China ahead of this week's negotiations. A whole delegation from Beijing was scheduled to get into D.C. on Wednesday. And so maybe this is just a tactic. We don't know.
Now, the president says China is the one that's being hurt by all of this, not the United States. There are many economists, though, that would disagree and say the U.S. is being hurt by this trade war.
Well, I think that the Chinese have certainly been bearing the brunt of it. But we also know that a lot of the costs that are incurred with these tariffs is being passed on to U.S. businesses and consumers. We had a really interesting report out from the University of Chicago and the Federal Reserve Bank, which showed that, remember those washing machine tariffs?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that cost consumers 80, 90 bucks extra for a washing machine. And then the weirdest thing that happened was Prices for dryers went up also. Because why? Manufacturers, both foreign and U.S., said, hey, here's an opportunity for us to raise our prices on both washers and dryers. So this costs consumers at the end of the day. It may not be a huge amount of money, but there is a cost.
What are the biggest sticking points right now with the trade negotiations with China?
Well, I think that we continue to see that the issue that really makes Washington crazy is that the Chinese have a practice of forcing U.S. companies to share technology either as a direct transfer or through joint ventures with Chinese companies as a condition for entering the Chinese market. And the Chinese have basically been quite reluctant to give on this point or to make any change that might require them to update their law in China. The U.S. has also demanded that in some situations going forward that it should be able to reimpose tariffs without fear of Chinese retaliation. And I think that would be a pretty tough pill for Beijing to swallow.
Jill, do you think that at the end of the day, at some point in the next several months or at least before the election in 2020, there's going to be a big announcement of some huge trade deal between the U.S. and China?
I think that there's going to be an announcement of a trade deal, and it's not going to be huge. I think that it's going to be very quietly tucked away. And in fact, this would really be a good news scenario for the marketplace, because even though they want U.S. businesses to be able to enter China, what they really don't want is a trade war. So if it just were to go away, that would be what investors would certainly like. And I'm sure the president would take credit for whatever deal was on the table, no matter how good or how middling it might be.
That's Jill Schlesinger, business analyst at CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Jill, thank you.
Thank you.
Let's check in now on Stockton, California, where an article for a high school newspaper made national headlines before it was even published. The Lodi Unified School District heard last month that the Bruin Voice, the student newspaper at Bear Creek High, was planning to publish student reporter Bailey Kirkaby's profile of fellow student Caitlin Fink, an 18-year-old senior who'd recently started a career in pornography. Now, the school district demanded that they be able to review the article before publication and threatened to fire the teacher advisor to the paper, which launched a cross-country debate about freedom of speech. In the end, the advisor got a lawyer, the school did not review the article, and it was published last Friday. Now, the district said they were worried about the article, whether it met legal requirements. They said the law requires districts to prevent the publication of obscenity, defamation, and incitement. Well, we wondered, what about concerns about the student? While the piece focuses on Caitlin's fledgling career, the school knew she'd moved out of her parents' home a few months ago, was paying rent to a friend's family, and said in the article she'd turned to selling erotic pictures of herself online to make money. Then she started to like the attention. Are there other questions here besides freedom of speech that the school should have addressed? Let's bring in Kathy Duffel. She's the aforementioned teacher advisor for the school newspaper, The Bruin Voice. And Kathy, you are not fired.
Not as yet.
Okay. Well, let's unfold this, unpack this for people who may not have been following this story. The paper, which is produced by an elective class, as it is in most schools, does publish profiles of, let's say, star athletes. And in this case, it was a young woman who was explaining how she got into the adult entertainment business.
Yes. Just to kind of give you an insight into our story cycle, we start out always with our editors sitting down either in a large group or with small groups, and they pitch their story ideas. And Bailey Kirkaby happened to be sitting with a small group, and one of the students in her group said, hey, I've been hearing about this girl that has been working in the adult entertainment industry, and kids have really been talking about her and some of them saying some mean things. And I wonder if this girl would be willing to clear up some of those rumors. And Bailey Kirkaby, the writer, first approached Caitlin as just a fellow student, her peer, and said, hey, what do you think about doing this story? And Caitlin was so very excited. She said, yes, I have been the subject of a lot of rumors, a lot of cruel comments, and I would really appreciate the opportunity to set the record straight. So one of the conditions that she agreed to do this story was that her name be used in the story.
Right. So this is Caitlin Fink, the senior, who tells a story of how she started selling erotic photos of herself on the instant messaging application Kick. and then expanded yes. selling pictures on Tinder, other applications. And she goes through and talks about her experience, and it's detailed in a very straightforward way. Then the school district gets wind of this and demands what?
It claimed that the article was possibly obscene, libelous, slanderous, incites commission of an unlawful act, is inconsistent with professional standards of English and journalism. It says, while the district does not maintain that the interview's publication is prohibited, the district has received information that Caitlin's interview will focus primarily on her production of adult videos. And so it requested, said, you are hereby directed to refrain from publishing the article prior to the district's review and approval. If I fail to provide a copy of the article as directed, I would be subject to discipline up to and including dismissal.
Okay. And you refused that. And this, of course, became a national story. A lot of support. Someone sent the paper a $250 yes. donation. Another woman sent $100, and she wanted to see the article.
Sneak peek, yes.
Yeah. So a lot of people supporting you, and the school backing down, and the article was published.
We were victorious on being able to publish the article, but as far as the district backing down on prior review, the last correspondence we received from their attorney makes it very clear that they intend to dig in their heels on the topic of prior review. And so that is obviously what our next battle will be. We won this battle, but this war is not over. This is a larger war about prior review for school newspapers, and the district does not seem to understand that.
Well, and this is not the first kerfuffle with this particular school newspaper. Do I understand that another time the district collected, over 1,000 copies of an article that had been written critical of the school safety policy?
Yes, I two incidents. I've been written up for insubordination after we ran a story about a principal who lost his master key for the third time, incurring a lot of expenses. And that was after he sent out a district-wide email chastising our own staff for the cost of rekeying the school. So he requested prior review a week in advance and wrote me up for insubordination for my refusal to do that. And then the story you referenced was a principal who, after we thoroughly went through the school's safety handbook, and this was after one of the mass shootings, we discovered it was so full of inaccuracies and outdated information, and we published that. And she thought that would make the school result in the disorderly operation of the school, so she confiscated all 1,700 copies and locked them up in her office. Yes.
Didn't those ultimately have to be redistributed as well?
Yes, they did.
Yeah. Look, you obviously believe very strongly that you and these students have the right of freedom of speech unimpaired by the school district reviewing what you are doing. But I have a separate question for you, aside from the freedom of speech, which, of course, we're very much in favor of. When I'm reading through the article, this 18-year-old woman goes through all the detailing of what has happened to her in her career. And this is part of what she wanted to get across, that it isn't all sunshine, that there's been a lot of problems. In fact, let's listen to what she said to KPIX 5 television in San Francisco about the attention to her article.
People think that if you're in adult entertainment, you're obligated to have sex with anyone, and you're not. Oh, she's a stripper. That means she doesn't have morals. You can still have morals and do a stripping job. Like, a job is a job. Sex work is still real work.
And your reporter, Bailey Kirkaby, as we said, details a lot of things that Caitlin Fink has done in this fledgling career. She's become a verified member of Pornhub. That's a pornographic website in which members post yes. erotic videos for others to view. She signed a contract with an agency.
Yes.
She talked about having to get her blood tested to make sure she doesn't have sexually transmittable diseases. But there's never a question in this article about whether or not she might be taking risks, about her own personal situation. Apparently, she'd had to move out of her family home. She started doing this for money. Given that, did you ever hesitate and think, well, geez, maybe, this is a girl who wants attention but might later regret it? I mean, it's not as if you are an independent newspaper outside of a school. You're also a teacher in the school. So I'm just wondering, do teachers have a responsibility beyond the free speech to think about that?
I think, of course, we do. We care about our students. Our students are almost like our own children to us in many ways. And I have had several conversations with Caitlin. I speak to Caitlin almost on a daily basis now that all this media storm has hit, just to check in with her mental health, just to make sure she's okay. I sat down personally, and I rarely do this with an interviewee. I let the students handle it. And I spoke to her several times one-on-one just to see what her maturity level was and would she be able to handle a story like this if we were to publish it. And I talked to Bailey Kirkaby at length about what she thought. And Bailey was convinced this was a girl who had every intention of pursuing this as a career, who was proud of what she was doing, who was happy. You know, what she does is not for everyone, obviously. This is, as it's headlined, there is some risk involved in this industry, and I think the story did a good job of presenting that risk.
Kathy Duffel, she's the advisor for the Bruin Voice, the student newspaper at Bear Creek High School in Stockton, California. The article's been published, but maybe the battle still continues over district prior review. Kathy, thanks so much for talking to us about it.
Oh, you're so welcome. Thank you for having me.
More tough talk from the White House today on Iran, with the Secretary of State saying that an escalation is taking place, just a day after the U.S. announced it's deploying an aircraft carrier and bomber task force to the Middle East because of troubling indications from Iran. Joining me now is Aaron David Miller, a distinguished fellow at the Wilson Center and former State Department Middle East analyst and negotiator. Aaron, welcome.
It's great to be here, Jeremy.
So Bolton says that this deployment of the aircraft carrier is meant to send a clear and unmistakable message to Iran after unspecified threats. What do you make of this?
That's the real problem. This week is the first anniversary of the Trump administration's withdrawal from the JCPOA, and it follows on the heels of crushing sanctions, both against the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps and the denial of waivers designed to cut Iran's oil exports to zero. So this is part, generally, of the administration's maximum pressure campaign against Iran, designed to do what is unclear. Whether or not this recent maneuver is just part of the pressure campaign, or whether, in fact, there really is intel indicating a sizable attack. It would have to be such a sizable attack to warrant this. And I think, by and large, this strikes me as overkill.
But you say it's unclear. I mean, we spoke recently with Jason Rezaian of The Washington Post, who spent 544 days in an Iranian prison, who said that the plan from the administration, it's very unclear what their plan is when it comes to Iran, whether they're trying to be on a path to war with Iran or whether they're just trying to increase the economic pressure or what.
I mean, I think that's the issue. Clearly, their campaign of maximum pressure is wreaking havoc, not only with oil exports, but with the Iranian economy. If, in fact, the purpose of these sanctions is to draw the Iranians back to the table, then the administration would have to have a position on negotiating with the Iranians that, in addition to sticks, also put carrots on the table. And I don't see that as the administration's position. Now, they deny that the goal is regime change. But it strikes me that maximum pressure, you know, is that I think it's designed to try to create circumstances in which the regime could collapse or even change. And I think that's unlikely to come to fruition.
Okay, let's talk about what's going on in Israel and in Gaza. There's a ceasefire that's been reached after days of violence. What sparked this latest violence over the weekend?
I mean, look, it's part of the wash, rinse, and repeat cycle. I don't mean to trivialize it because it's tragic. It involves losses of lives on both sides, more on the Palestinian side, to be sure. You have a group, Hamas, whose raison d'etre and legitimacy is derived from armed struggle, which is governing 2 million people badly in the Gaza Strip and seeking to compel the Israelis to induce certain economic changes that would improve Hamas's capacity to deliver to its constituencies. And earlier on, before the Israeli elections, there were intense negotiations between Israel and Hamas to come up with a package of steps, expanding the fishing zone, ending restrictions on some goods being imported into Gaza. And I suspect Hamas, understanding that Israel is hosting the Eurovision contest, mm-hmm. singing contest in a couple weeks, and with Independence Day looming, sought to take advantage of the leverage to remind the Israelis of their commitments and their obligations and force an acceleration of this agreement. And I think it was incumbent. The Israelis were compelled, given the politics of the situation and the intensity of the shelling, to basically respond. But so far, it's resulted in the way these have usually ended, with the Egyptians launching an intense period of mediation, creating a ceasefire, which appears to be holding.
Well, and how do the politics in Israel play into this? Netanyahu just got a fifth term as prime minister last month. He's also facing a potential indictment soon.
Right. And he's also facing a number of right-wing parties, particularly Mr. Lieberman's party, who was minister of defense and is likely to be given that portfolio again. And he's advocated a much tougher line. So the notion that the prime minister is going to make major concessions to Hamas during the period of government formation is fanciful thinking. I suspect if the Egyptians mediated anything, it was a commitment on the part of the Israelis to begin these rather basic steps with any more meaningful concessions or decisions made on prisoner releases, the development of infrastructure in the Gaza Strip, reserving those for much later.
And just to be clear, you were serious about saying that Eurovision is playing into both sides here, the Eurovision contest coming up?
Yes, it's a huge deal for the Israelis. And even though every Israeli public official said that the Eurovision schedule is not going to allow or change Israel's efforts to defend itself, which is true, there's no question that cancellation of that would be a blow to Israel's mm-hmm. prestige.
That's Aaron David Miller, a distinguished fellow at the Wilson Center and former State Department Middle East analyst and negotiator. Thanks as always.
Jeremy, thank you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.